Can I ask everybody please take their seats?
Hello, sir.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Flores. I'm currently serving as president of the Fish and Game Commission. Welcome to day two of our hearing here in Mammoth, California. I'd like to make a few introductions. Sitting down a couple seats away from me is Mr. Bob Hatoy, who is currently serving as vice president. He's from Santa Monica. Next to him is Commissioner Jim Kellogg from Concord, California. And off to my immediate left is Cindy Gustafson from Tahoe City. And Commissioner Rogers is ill, and so he's not with us this week. We wish him the best. Also with us, Mr. Carlson, our executive director, sitting next to me. Also up here on the dais is Sherry Cole and Adriana Shea. They're two of our analysts, but they happen to be two of our now award-winning analysts. They just received silver merits.
Sustained accomplishment.
Sustained accomplishment for directors. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but I also wanted to acknowledge. So now I can all call them award-winning staff. We also have Mr. John Fisher. He's assistant executive director, and also up here is our General Counsel, Mr. William Cunningham. I'd also like to introduce the department's director, Mr. Ryan Broderick. Welcome, Ryan, and Sankey Mastrup, deputy director. Also with us in the audience, the guys and gals at Where the Rubber Meets the Road. Chief of Enforcement, Ms. Nancy Foley, Captain John Baker, and Warden Chad Elliott, and thank you all for being here today. All right, I think I got everybody. Did I miss anybody? All right. Yes, I did already. Let's do the announcement out of executive session, and then I'm going to go off agenda and have an introduction, have somebody speak.
With that, good morning, Mr. President, members of the Commission, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General. I would like to report that we did meet in executive session yesterday afternoon. As everybody knows, the Commission meets in executive session to talk about matters involving litigation, or in this case also matters involving permit appeals and questions. We did review six different permit appeals yesterday, and I can identify all six of those. Those were for Linda Southern, Randy Toussaint, Pete Bompensiero, Kurt Schoonover, Philip Freeman, and Ryan Hill. All six of those were reviewed on appeal. All six of those were denied. In this case, transferable permits were not issued, and also a spot prawn trap vessel and a rock crab trap permit were not issued. So that's all we had to report out of executive session. We did also, as always, refer and talk about some of our matters in litigation, but nothing to report, no action to report out on any of those cases. And that's all I have, Mr. President. Thank you.
Talk about the awards. And one other thing that was reported in executive session, and President Flores alluded to it a little bit ago, four members of the Commission staff received a sustained accomplishment award from the director of the Fish and Game, Ryan Broderick, and we just wanted to acknowledge their award. My 6 months on this commission, I couldn't survive as much as I have without the staff, excellent staff, and they really helped me out a lot, and I'm glad they got that award.
Should probably mention the other two individuals that...
Sherry Tiemann and John Snellstrom, who are back at the office in Sacramento, and they're probably watching right now. Well-deserved to get that award, and Adriana and Sherry here. So they all deserved it. It was a team award, and they did a great job, and they continue to do a great job for the commission.
Yeah, they got a beautiful plaque and a monetary award. So that's a good one.
Okay, I'm going to have allow Dr. Staub to come up and speak for a few moments. Yesterday we had an item up on the agenda regarding the CEQA document and request. And I had asked yesterday if Dr. Staub had been notified, and while he had, I forgot I had a conversation with him and told him I'd move this item to Friday so he could be here. And so that was my mistake. So I'm going to allow him a chance to speak. And I think he and Sankey have had some discussions. We might have some announcements to make.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Rick Staub. I apologize for not coming tomorrow. It was my understanding that it was just going to be an update also and not actually go into the merits of the proposal. So you can imagine my dismay when I was watching it online and suddenly they were talking about actual items and not a forward agenda or a review of the timeline. I appreciate this opportunity to talk, though. There's several emails there clearly showing that there was an agreement between Mr. Mastrop and myself at the direction of the commission to collaborate on writing a CEQA document for this proposal. I don't want to rehash all of it, but it's there for your perusal. Jumping down to item number four, going back to the August 29, 2002 commission meeting when Sandra Morey presented the proposal that listed the four criteria for adding species to the propagation permit. I opposed that permit at that time, or that proposal at that time, and stated that it set a burden of proof on the applicant that was so high that it couldn't be met. Ms. Morey responded saying that it was not the intention of the Fish and Game to make it that burdensome. You can go back and look at the minutes and listen to them. It's exactly what she said. Clearly that's not the case. A gentleman yesterday, I didn't catch his name on the web, but the first guy who presented the timeline said that the applicant has to present an environmental review. I'm sorry, but those five criteria do not list an environmental review as one of the criteria. And it lists a review of the literature, which I did. But you can see how this has morphed into this huge issue, and now there's a CEQA requirement on it. And that wasn't one of the requirements either when Sandra Morey presented it. So it's really gotten to the point where it's reached a burden that's just practically unmeetable by anybody in the general public. Moving down to agenda item number five, I got his name wrong. I apologize for that. Mr. Updike and Mr. Mastrop brought up several issues, and it was a little ingenuous. They kind of suggested that these were new issues. These are not new issues. They were brought up in the original application by Ryan Hoyer. I addressed them then. I addressed them in 2004, and I addressed them in the CEQA document. So what it comes down to really is that the CEQA document that I prepared came up with a negative declaration, basically a no impact, and that goes against the bias of the department that believes that captive propagation and commercial sale of those captive babies is somehow going to spur illegal activity. The problem with that is they have no support for their position. Going forward with this, and I was talking with Mr. Mastrop before the meeting, I would suggest that this review that I presented gets put out for review. If the department has issues with it, then I would suggest the commission agendize it and have them come in and present those issues and support them. I'd be glad to show up. Past that, we discussed organizing a body to address on a larger issue, broader reptile management by the department, although I would consider that separate from this proposal that I have in front of you for adding the two species to the propagation permit. And that's all I have.
Does the department want to respond? Or?
Yes, commissioners. This is a situation where, you know, we just simply don't have anybody to work on reptiles. That's been a problem for a while. We have reorganized our wildlife branch, and we're hoping maybe we can relook at our workloads and see if we can break somebody loose. Dr. Staub and I did chat before this morning to talk about, well, how do we actually get somewhere with this? And I was actually discussing with him this notion of maybe forming, he knows a lot of experts in the field. We don't really have any experts anymore on reptiles. So maybe form a working group where we can have working with an enforcement rep and one of our environmental scientists, work with a group that can kind of keep this thing moving and look at a strategy for reptiles, and because there's a lot of issues here. There's sport take, there's status, and then and this issue of commercialization would be a subset of that, and maybe do a review for us, kind of like a strategic plan. What could we do or should we be doing with reptiles? It's an area that needs more work. We just have not had the capacity. And if Mr. Staub could help organize that, I think we could make the commitment to have at least somebody participate to share, at least provide contacts and share information we have and concerns that then this group of experts could help us go through. This is not unprecedented, this approach, so that's kind of about the only option we have at the moment.
And what about his suggestion about sending his document out for peer review?
Well, I mean, that's a great idea, actually. And I think maybe form a committee to, I mean, you could, well, it sounds like he has a group of individuals we could use as a peer review, and then we'll find some others, too. I mean, that can be done any time. It's just one of our concerns is I'm not sure, we haven't had a chance to look at his document, whether all of our issues are in there, because there's no point in doing a peer review until we've had a chance to at least incorporate some issues that may not be in there. So, but at that point, it'd be totally appropriate.
I just see it. If you send it out for review and it comes back with those issues, then you address those issues then. And if the department doesn't have the expertise in there to review it, then give it to somebody who does.
Mr. President, Commissioners, just one response, and this is not directed to Dr. Staub, but the issue in general, burden of proof under CEQA, that's a burden of proof that we share, everyone shares, as an applicant or as a project proponent. So independent of the merits of the document, when it comes to changes and regulations that are proposed, either the department in its normal course of business or the applicant who wants dispensation from a regulation, that CEQA obligation and that bar is set by statute. It's set by case law. And we have to meet that, you know, that bar. You watched it as we did our mammal regs, our fishing regs. So if there's a bias in terms of what we think is sufficient that isn't consistent with the guidelines and requirements of CEQA, Dr. Staub has an appropriate concern. But that sometimes, as you've watched over the last 10 years, that bar has gotten higher and higher. That's just the nature of the business when it comes to adopting regulations, whether it be fishing regulations or captive breeding, that bar is there.
Well, where do we go from here, Salky?
Well, I think with Dr. Staub's help, maybe he can help generate a list of experts we could circulate his document for, yeah, working group. I think that's the only rational approach at this point because we cannot do it currently. We're going to need help, and if we can get a list of people we could send the document to for review, I'll tag a few of our staff, both enforcement and wildlife, to, you know, pencil their thoughts and issues so we can add it to it and get it out there, at least get initial review. I think that makes the most sense at this point. And if the commission finds that acceptable, I'll work with Dr. Staub promptly to try and get this working group organized.
That's the key word for me.
Promptly?
Yes.
Yeah. So if that's your interest, we can work on that.
Can we expect an update?
Yeah, we'll report back to you at the next meeting.
Okay.
August 3rd, I guess, since the 2nd is devoted to MLPA.
Yeah.
And okay, Carlson will remind us to put that on the agenda. So.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
All set. We're ready to roll.
Okay. We have two items that left over from yesterday. One is a new business item that Bill Cunningham would like to bring to the attention of the commission.
Mr. President, members of the commission, Bill Cunningham, we did forget one additional item of new business yesterday when we did have a new business discussion. I'd like to call to the commission's attention that we have received a letter asking that the commission examine and perhaps adopt regulations dealing with the identification of trammel nets for herring fishery. Unfortunately, this letter was received quite literally at the last minute before we assembled the agenda, and it has not been reviewed by the department nor the commission staff in any depth at all. I would like to suggest that this is probably a petition for regulatory action, in which case the commission needs to either accept it, table it with reference to the department, or reject it at this point in time. The Administrative Procedures Act normally requires that we take some action on a petition for rulemaking within 30 days, and I would like to recommend to the commission that in this specific request for rulemaking, we refer this to the department for evaluation and further discussion before we take any further action on the matter. So in essence, we would table this matter with a referral to the department.
I'd make a motion that that's what we do, table the matter until we have the department review it and come back to us.
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you very much.
Public comment on that item, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. You don't want to take up the withering syndrome, the sibellid worm, or the outplanting of abalones as old business. Let's bring it up as new business. We were promised to have the Disease Control Committee's recommendations and report on the withering syndrome. We have not gotten that. The public has not had that. It is not on any of your websites. It has not been produced or given to the public. You don't want to take it up under old business. Let's take it up under new business then. The Disease Control Committee's recommendations were supposed to be given to us and be part of the abalone recovery and management plan. It was not. We know that you don't want to talk about the withering syndrome, the devastating abalone disease.
I'm sorry, Paul, you need to talk about what we just talked about, that herring letter. If you have something new like that, some public forum, and you did that yesterday.
No, it's not.
No, this agenda item, you need to speak to what we bring up as new business. This is not for you to bring up new business. Thank you for your comments. One other thing from yesterday, item 9A1A, which is the Marine Resources Committee, and this is Mr. Hatoy is going to bring this forward from the Marine Resources Committee, and this is the nominations for the San Miguel Island Abalone Fishery Advisory Group.
Yeah. Commissioner Rogers, who chairs the committee, as you mentioned, President Flores isn't here today, so he asked me to forward this to the commission for action of acceptance. These are the applicants and the recommendations of the department, and the Marine Subcommittee looked over them too and did some due diligence, and they're good folks. You see the recommendation. They're from fishery science, commercial fishing, recreational diving, marine conservation, and government agencies. There's a select group, and then there's also a few people that are asterisk in order to show that we have some backup people in case something happens. As I understand it, this is the final list, Sankey, because it was one or two people that were.
This is the modified list.
Thank you. And all these people have been vetted, and they want to go to work, and we need just a commission action to accept this, if that's what the commission's feeling is. So that's what we have in front of us, and you know, I guess I'll like to make a motion to accept this.
Can we add at a later date if there's somebody on here that is not? I had put a candidate forward, and I'm not. I can't remember
who it was or what happened.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to everybody. I mean, some people took themselves off. Some people, yeah, I just don't know. I'm not trying to be unresponsive. I just don't know what happened to everybody. This is the final list based on a whole Rubik's Cube of having to need certain types of people.
So do I have that ability?
To add people later?
Yes.
I guess the agreement among the recommendation for this advisory group was to have this many people. Adding somebody, if someone wants to resign or change, well, it might be, you know, what I'm trying to say is, yeah, this is sort of the group that looked at each other.
I understand.
You know, you hear what I'm
let
saying.
Let me... No, the point is, Bob, yeah, I just got this. So I've had a time to vet it myself and take a look and do some research to see who these folks are.
Okay.
So I just want to be able to have that ability if
well,
need,
then
so
we can postpone it if that's what you want to do. We just thought this was, you asked us to vet it with the staff and make a recommendation to you. We did, and you have the right, of course, to vet it and continue it if you want.
Sankey?
Could I make a recommendation? We're, as you know, we're on a very tight timeline. We have our surveys starting in August. We're in the middle of this What I would recommend is if you find it appropriate, approve this list. Let us get the committee going. If you want to add members later, you can always do that. It's just they're going to have a slight disadvantage. I believe the individual you referenced was Milo.
Yeah.
But he withdrew himself when he found out he had an adequate representative alternative. Because most of the meetings are going to be in Santa Barbara, and he lives in the north.
Exactly.
Okay.
So he was on the original list, but when he talked to the other reps, he decided he didn't need to be there, and he withdrew his name.
Okay.
Yeah, he took himself out. I remember that story now. Thank you.
Well, I'll second that motion.
Sure.
Thank you.
You made. I just had a quick question. Dr. Newman, there's a statement in Dr. Newman's reference that says, and we just received this, so I'm sorry I'm asking this now, that NOAA's not particularly supportive of her involvement. I mean, it was added in there, so I just thought I'd ask what that meant.
Where are I put that? Go ahead, Santi.
Yeah, there's not a great, there's varying levels of support for the whole notion.
Okay.
And we're encouraging them to participate because what we didn't want is them not having their voice and concerns expressed in a working group. So we strongly encourage them to have a rep.
Okay.
They're just not real either, apparently.
Okay, great. So it wasn't about her involvement, it was their involvement.
Right, and they're committed to the process, but not committed yet to any particular.
Great. Thank you.
All right. We have a. Your motion. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Very good.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you. One public speaker on this item, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Looking at this list, it doesn't seem fair and equitable that there are three representatives from recreational diving and governmental agency. It would seem that it'd be more fair if there were only two representatives from each one of these entities. How is it that there is all lopsided and overwhelming votes that are going to be ability for them to outweigh the others on the board? This doesn't seem fair or equitable, and especially Mr. Gary Davis, who we've had issues with in the past. I was told to submit something in writing, again, duplicate, redundancy, about Gary Davis, but then my group has overruled me, saying that we know well what Gary Davis thinks, what he will say, and what he will do. This is better than having someone that we do not know. But as far as I say it, there seems to be a lopsided representation here, and it would be more appropriate to have two representatives instead of three from the recreational diving and governmental agency. Thank you.
Thank you. Now move to item 14 on today's agenda. Consideration of department recommendation for species to be depicted on the California Duck Stamp 2007-2011 and the Ducks Unlimited Marsh projects. I'd like to introduce the waterfowl biologist extraordinaire for the department, Dan Perigary. And yeah, exactly. I think that's his official title. We also have in the audience who's going to help him out on this item and the next item, Brad Bales from the state of Oregon. He's Dan's counterpart, the waterfowl biologist in Oregon. So between the two of them, we've got the Pacific Flyway pretty much covered here today. So any questions on the Pacific Flyway, I just let you guys go for it.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the Commission, Dan Perigary, Wildlife Program.
I always knew you needed help.
Go ahead. Do I need help? More help? More help than normal? This is a pretty straightforward agenda item for you. I wanted to start off, though, with a photograph of the current year duck stamp, which was just selected about 3 or 4 weeks ago by Sherry Russell. And that's not a duck. It's actually a goose. This is a white-fronted goose. By way of background, the statutes allow you guys to stipulate the species. We've been, in my history for the last 18 years, doing 5 years at a time. So this was the last of five. It's the greater white-fronted goose. And that will be our duck stamp species in 2006-2007. In the memorandum recommendation to you, there's a list of all the species we've used over time. And at the bottom are the five species that we're recommending for the next 5 years. I took the liberty, because I don't know everybody's familiarity with waterfowl, to try and get some quick pictures. Some are better quality than others. This is a pair of redhead ducks. This is the northern shoveler. Your favorite bird. Barrow's
Golden Eye. Favorite bird.
Northern Pintail, which we've used quite a bit, but it's a very popular duck in our state, and the Aleutian Canada Goose, which was the subject of the Alaska State Duck Stamp in 1996, to give you a feel for what some other states do. That was all we had here. If there's any questions.
I have a quick question that's self-serving. Do we get prints any more of these fabulous things this year?
The short answer, no.
My short response is damn.
Yeah.
You know. Okay.
However, they are for sale.
Okay. No, that's okay. But because of reasons not wanting to be discussed here, we don't get them anymore. So we can still buy them.
Yeah. I mean, okay. if you'd like to talk about our process for selecting the duck stamp artist and contract, we're more than able to do that.
Sure.
Oh. You do want to talk about that.
Sure.
Okay. Historically, from 1971 to about 1995, the department conducted just a straight art contest in which the species was identified by the commission, and folks from all over the state would submit artwork. A panel of judges was formed, and the best piece of artwork was picked to be depicted on the stamp. A secondary art market developed in that period of time, and where waterfowl art became more and more interesting and valuable. And so the artist, while they gave us the image to depict on our stamp and we sold the stamp, they then made a financial gain. Legislation, the Duck Stamp Act, was changed, which allowed the department to enter into contracts. And basically what we've done since about 1995 or 96 is put what we call a request for proposals out on the street, which basically says, this is the species we want you to depict. How much money will you give us if you win the contract? We worked under that system until last year, in which we changed the scoring criteria. The candidates or the proponents are given a list of criteria that their history in marketing and producing waterfowl art could be judged against. And we went through that. 2 years ago, we changed the criteria a little bit to incorporate more of an art contest competition to it. So in this year, to get you totally up to speed, the criteria were largely the same. We actually took the proposals and broke them into two parts, one of which was the business part, and the other one was the art part. And they were judged independently against the criteria that were provided to the proponents in the RFP. And so you get a score based on these various criteria. The art part, of course, is much more subjective. But we used a panel of three folks in both places. So that's how we get there.
Who was the panel?
The business side was our Deputy Director, Bernadette Fees, Sarah Edmonds, who's our contract manager, and Melanie Weaver, who's the other biologist in the waterfowl program. The art contract, and I'm very sorry, we got a artist who actually competed in the 1995 or 94 stamp, and I'm sorry I forget his name right now because I just met him in time for that, but he's an artist. Myself and your executive director. So
I have a quick question following up. Yeah. I think it's great art, and it's great that it's available still. What kind of money does waterfowl art generate in general, if you can?
In past years, I don't have any current figures available to me, but we generally budget in the order of $50,000 to $100,000 a year in royalties that the department's getting. We have no idea, really, what the individual artist might make.
Cool. Thank you.
Who all submitted?
We had two proponents this year, Mr. Steiner and Sherry Russell Moline.
And Dan, I have in my notes, it was Ted Moroz. Oh,
thank you. I don't have my notes with me. Thank you.
Thanks.
So we're going to continue with this sort of system throughout?
I believe we'd be open for any discussion on that.
Okay.
Now, my understanding is what the department, the move they've made the last couple of years to try and encourage as many artists to submit, and they've changed some of the business, the RFP a bit to try and encourage that, but it's been difficult to get more artists to throw their name in the ring.
Business side, is it still require an investment from the artist up front?
Well, that's the way it's been handled in recent years, in which the artist guarantees a revenue stream to us. And I'm sorry I don't have the criteria with me to talk about in great detail. I didn't know that you'd want to go there today. But it's a two-part thing, whereas before we changed it, it was all about the money. And as you can see, we had one artist for about 7 or 8 years mm-hmm. straight in a row. With the criteria change, we got a different artist with a different style and a different approach to marketing to some extent. And, of course, it's new, so we don't really know where we're at financially yet. But
there's because you only had two artists doesn't mean that there wasn't available to have more artists. Just the two finalists, or
no, we only had two proponents. My gut feel is that if we went back to a straight art competition and totally eliminated the revenue part of it, we'd probably get a slew of art.
Yeah.
But it's the part where we're asking folks to put together a marketing package and kind of tell us how much they'll contribute.
Well, I'm actually, for my benefit as a commissioner, more comfortable with the way it's being done now than the way it was being done before, where you had one person monopolizing the art year after year.
Well, you'd be more for the open then. Yeah, I mean, that's the way I'd like to see it more competitive. I understand your concerns. I've talked to a lot of artists that want to participate, but they don't have the wherewithal to put up that sort of financial.
Yeah, and see, that's what's interesting about Sherry Russell and Rich Radegonda last year. They're actually using a different individual to do the marketing part.
Yeah.
So that model's out there that Mr. Steiner, just to pick on him, you know, he could market other people's art. I'm not sure why he would. But this Carlos Ficarelli, who's actually handling the business part for Mr. Radegonda and Sherry Russell, he doesn't care who the artist is. So he could package several different pieces of art. And I think the word needs to get out a little
further. I'm wondering if maybe the approach is to pick two different. I mean, pick a marketing firm for the business side, and then have a full-blown contest for the art side. So you don't have to worry about mm-hmm. those issues that we all know about down the road. And that way, if I'm just a hell of an artist, but I don't know anything about business, I just like to do artwork, mm-hmm. I can go ahead and compete. Mm-hmm. I mean, I participated this year in the Junior Duck Stamp, and it was a pretty awesome event to see all those kids submitting all that artwork. So I think, you know, I've talked to several artists that want to do it, and they're pretty big artists. They probably have the ability to do it. But if we can come up with a way where we can just say, okay, well, let's put out a bid for the marketing aspects of it, and let's go out and just have full-blown contest and, you know, get a couple more judges in there, throw some commissioners in there, and whoever else, and let's go at it.
He's looking at
Yeah, well, I think it's out of his purview, but it's, you know, it's.
No, those are good comments, and I think on point, what we tried to do with this program, and Commissioner Kellogg referenced it, this was initially all about, you know, the money, and the money was important because we need these dollars, mm-hmm. and sends, you know, two important messages. It provides funds for programs, and those funds have direct fidelity to wetlands programs, so the buyer, whether they're buying them to collect and care about waterfowl, or they're buying them as a condition of being a licensed hunter in California, they know that dollar is going back into wetland habitats and to the species they care about. And there has become a significant secondary market, and there's a lot of ritual related to owning mm-hmm. a duck prints. I'm just thinking on the wall that I have at home, and I don't know how much grief I get from my wife. She says a wall's quack instead of... But anyway, not to digress, but the issue there is we had one artist, and he was a very good businessman, very good artist, but there had become a general sense in the community that it was a perpetual contract. So we changed our criteria not to discount this person as a competitor, but not to provide, to level the playing field. So having accomplished that, and then with a change in an artist, Rich Radegonda getting last year. And I think from what I've heard, the sales are good, and you wait for the numbers to come in. But the key is that balance between having an open art competition that really honors and highlights the beautiful, you know, waterfowl of this state, in which you have setting the criteria in terms of the species that are the subject, and producing income
that's critical to the program and critical to the continuing the message that, you know, hunters and folks that buy duck stamps are investing directly in an affirmative action into their habitat. So we're willing to make this program evolve more. Bernadette fees, as you saw in some of the fishing regs and outdoor cow, changing formats, increasing the amount of advertising because we're changing and improving the product. So we're willing to have that discussion. The flip side of that is it takes a lot of time and staff time, and I've tried to take most of this off Dan and Melanie's back because they're great biologists, but it really becomes a business proposition with business people. And we want to maintain that income. So I think we're working towards a credible program. We're willing to entertain and talk about, you know, alternatives. But two issues: make it open and produce money. And those are the, you know, the, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. But we can continue to work on how to accomplish that. And I think we've, you know, with the selection of this year's artist, widely recognized. I think the word will get out that it's not a locked system. So I'm looking forward to next year.
Yeah, no, I, you know, if you maintain that approach, and the word obviously gets out, but I think the sort of the approach that I just mentioned, I think is one that will really open it wide, and you'll get quite a few folks if you sort of take that dual approach. But.
Yeah, if I may, the only kind of, this is way out of my bailiwick, but the only comment I might make is that a marketing proposal absent the artist, if you think about that, you might be asked to market something that might be unmarketable depending on which piece of art is selected.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to think about what they might be willing to provide us in terms of royalties when they don't know what they're going to be asked to market. So that just the only thought that occurred to me there.
Well, do they don't know that going in, though. I mean,
well, but when they're coupled up with an artist, when Mr. Vicarelli coupled up with Sherry,
sure,
Russell Moline, he knew what he was going to be asked to,
sure,
market. But if you just asked him to give us a royalty payment schedule on a piece of art he hasn't seen with an artist he might not have ever heard of, the marketing, I know I wouldn't guarantee as high a royalty if I didn't know who I was marketing. So.
But it seems like we don't have to. If you're a marketing firm, you would look at the historical and sort of cultural values that we put on selection,
yeah,
of the duck stamp, and you're not going to get a Daffy Duck cartoon to market.
Yeah.
You're going to get some
That's
beautiful
probably, yeah,
representation.
I mean,
of,
yeah,
of,
I mean, you've got the reputation.
Ball.
It is the California stamp, so,
yeah, so
that in itself is going to sell.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
I just like the idea of involving more artists, and obviously it's a money-making opportunity,
yeah,
also.
I agree.
Okay. Did you talk about the marsh projects?
In my simple mind, what we would need is the blessing that these five species are your preference for the next 5 years. And then we can.
We actually had combined the motion with the marsh projects, but we can separate them if you want. It's your guys' call. It's all on the same agenda.
We had Redhead, Spoony, Aleutian, Pintail.
Yeah, we already.
What was the last time
we did
Mallard?
We already did that.
What was the last time we did a Mallard?
I'd have to look myself.
1996.
2003.
Okay. All right, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, fine. We have to vote on that?
Yeah, but we'll couple it with the vote on the marsh projects, the same agenda item. So,
okay.
Unless there's any more questions on the waterfowl for the stamp, if you could go ahead and give a presentation on
this. Yeah,
well,
we really
project.
Don't have much here. You have all the bloody and gory detail. You know, the department's review process on duck stamp proposals is we request proposals throughout the state from anybody with an interest in wetland habitat management and conservation. We get a package of those. We sit down and review them with an advisory committee that's made up of Fish and Wildlife Service, California Waterfowl, and who am I missing? Ducks Unlimited. Then we're also secondarily reviewed by an internal review committee, and this package of proposals is put before you. It's, in this case, I think 25 independent projects. Most of the projects that were submitted are approved for funding. We're spending up to the spending authority we have for this dedicated account, and we think these are the best projects for you at this time.
How about adding, I see you've never used a blue wing down the road, your next proposal.
be more than happy to. Okay. And I would like to see us get them all. I mean, we've got a rich diversity of waterfowl in the state.
Well, if there's no questions on the waterfowl or the marsh projects, we need a motion to accept the department's recommendation on both of those items.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Brad, did you want to make a comment on that, or was the next item? Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to move to item 15, receipt of public recommendations and request for authorization to publish notice of intent to consider amendments of the migratory game waterfowl regulations for 2006-2007. And Dan?
Mr. President, Commission, Dan Perigary. You know, normally at this time, we don't have a lot of status information. We certainly don't have the regulatory frameworks from the Fish and Wildlife Service. But in your packet this year, we have at least one recommendation that is very unusual and new for us in California, which is why I wanted to spend a few minutes going over that one with you. And then I have just a couple little updates on status of ducks and habitats. So if I could just run through those two things in combination, I'll get out of your way. Steve, now I am ready again. The slideshow again will start somewhere in the middle. Thank you. I would have liked to have recommended Aleutian geese for this coming year because of this proposal we have in front of you, but since we used white-fronted geese in 06-07, I felt, you know, geese 2 years in a row was kind of boring. So if we can get to that. I went wrong, too far. What have I done? Steve, help. Go back, please. Aleutian geese, when we get back to this, are truly an interesting success story. I'm personally proud to have been part of this since the mid-1970s, if I go back a little bit. Early as the mid-1960s, the bird was thought to be extinct. It was rediscovered on its breeding grounds. Bird was listed as endangered. And through recovery efforts, including hunter closures and stuff, we've restored this thing. Bird was downgraded to threatened in, I think, 1991 and removed from the endangered species list in 2001. And anybody that's had a populations ecology course would say, gee, you should have seen that coming. Once you get to that logistic growth part, it's kind of heading out of control. And our best current estimate for 2005 is now over 100,000 of these things. So. Good news, though, while it's a truly awe-inspiring sight, and I would really encourage you guys, if you ever get out and talk to us about places to see this, you can't carry on a conversation over the sound of 50,000 geese in the air at once. It's truly a neat thing. However, with that comes a little bit of downside. I know you've received a letter from the Farm Bureau. These geese winter in the Central Valley and spend their spring months from January really through mid-April on the north coast of California, where most of the land is private, most of it is small dairies and small beef pasture operations, and almost all of that is suitable goose forage. And so what we've proposed in this package this year is a late-season hunt to try and control depredation. These farmers have had a significant loss in income from forage loss to geese, as well as costs associated with hazing these geese. And so by going to a late season, and we're recommending February 24th to March 10th, we can use hunting as a hazing tool. Now, the wrinkle to this is that the good news is we've been meeting with these farmers, the resource agencies and stuff, for a number of years. It's a coordinated approach, and we're actually making some process. We need to amend the federal frameworks. So to do that, we need the Flyway Council's approval at their meeting in July, and then we'll need the Fish and Wildlife Service's approval to actually have this opportunity for you to adopt that. One of the wrinkles in this is the Flyway Management Plan for this species calls for no net change in distribution from these birds. Stepping back a bit by way of history, cackling Canada geese, for example, used to winter almost entirely in California. They've now moved into the state of Oregon. So that's why Brad's here, because he has quite a bit of experience dealing with depredation by Canada geese. We'd like to not see that happen again. We've lost part of our waterfowl heritage by those birds. Now, I tell Brad he shortstopped them. He tells us that, you know, we ran them out with our human population growth. But in order to have a late season hunt to control depredation, we believe those birds need to have a place to stay rather than Oregon. And so we're going to recommend that we restrict access during that late season to our public areas, which are relatively small in Del Norte and Humboldt counties. And so we knew that that might have some problems with the hunting public. I was hoping that CWA would be here today to talk about the nexus with the SHARE program. They've hired a couple folks. They got boots on the ground up there talking to farmers, lining people up, and there will be public hunting opportunity, perhaps through the SHARE program or just, you know, through landowners' own use. So we wanted to give you that heads up, knowing that there was some potential issues there, and that's what I had on that one. And then by real quick update, give you a couple of current information. Some of you may have seen our press release. Our breeding surveys for mallards went up about 25% this year. Notice those bars are our 95% confidence intervals, so statistically these numbers are not different. We're not surprised at the point estimate increase because last year was so wet. Our age ratios in the harvest were very high. We had very good production last year. We would expect a similar sort of year this year. That's just for mallards, which are the most abundant duck in our survey, and I'm sorry I worked up the scale on this, but all species combined showed a small increase and at about the long-term average. And of course, most of the ducks we harvest in California actually come from the prairie provinces of Canada, and you might or not be able to read some of that, but in this case, green is good, and a lot of the key areas that will produce ducks for California seem to be having very good wetland habitat conditions. So that's what I know about all that stuff. Are there any questions for me? We'll have more for you in August.
Thank you, Dan. Now that we need to move that five-year duck stamp plan and approve the recommendation.
We did that already. That last vote was for that. This is for the regs, and we actually, Brad Bales from Oregon, did you want to say a few things, or were you? Right. So
I think important, this is somewhat unusual for us. This is a cooperative arrangement with our sister state to the north on this issue, and I think it would be important for the commissioners to kind of understand their situation and why we're working together on this.
Yeah, and that's why earlier I mentioned, you know, Dan and Brad are both heavily involved in the Pacific Flyway system, you know, and on committees and work, been on it for years. So between the two of them, they've got a lot of knowledge for Pacific Flyway waterfowl.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President. Commissioner, I appreciate this opportunity to speak. And I would acknowledge the longstanding cooperative efforts through the Flyway, but in particular with between California and Oregon, and especially Ryan and Sonke's recent presence on the Flyway Council and down on the study committee with myself. It's been a long, good partnership over the years. Oregon has a long tradition over a couple of decades now in the Willamette Valley dealing with depredation issues. It's one of the most complex systems in North America for management and regulations. The Aleutian situation is somewhat similar. It's not quite as complex, but again, I think a good chance for partnership and working together on trying to deal with this. Today, I just wanted to kind of share a little bit of the management philosophies that we deal with these late season hunts. In Oregon, we've had about the last decade a February-March type of situation in the Willamette Valley. And basically, the state has put this, that these are landowner assistance programs. That's the priority, helping landowners with hazing. It's not so much important as recreational hunting, but we do use hunters as kind of the second component. We don't want to exclude them from being a management tool, even though we're not promoting total recreation, but as a landowner assistance program. And then in conjunction with that is the habitat component on public lands, making sure that on state and federal refuges, the habitat components are good. We have places for the geese to forage. And in conjunction with that, as Dan mentioned, one of the issues about having public hunting on these state and federal lands during a depredation hunt like this. Our philosophy has been primarily that those lands have been closed, so these geese have some place to go when they're hazed off of private lands. And so I just want to kind of share that those basic management philosophies we use with that. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. So that the late season hunt up there has been real successful?
In general, the season is very complex. I mean, there's different levels of success, I think, depending on who you talk to. But it has helped a lot in spreading out the hunting opportunities using a three-way split season and extending that. hunt into a time of year when we didn't really have any other management tools. So from that standpoint, it has been successful.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Ryan has some comments.
Just ever so briefly, just to reinforce this Lucian goose. It's a remarkable story because it was thought to be extinct and then endangered and then threatened. Incredible effort from Alaska all the way down through the Central Valley. Some of the first acquisitions that the department made in the Central Valley outside of our traditional wildlife areas where we bought easements for the benefit of Lucian goose. I had the pleasure of serving on the Service Regulation Committee as a representative from the Pacific Flyway. And I can tell you, explaining to the rest of the flyways at the Service Regs Committee, that we were asking not only to harvest Lucian geese, but increase the harvest of Lucian geese after they had had 30 years of experience of protecting them as a threatened and endangered species was an interesting sales job. But the data was very much there and supportive. This is kind of the next step. The Farm Bureau letter and the individuals that Dan and Brad and others have worked with have been supportive and cooperators in the recovery of this species. And as Dan's chart showed, there's just been a tremendous increase since the delisting, since we actually opened the season. So this really is an effort to provide a management tool that supports the landowners who were in large part a critical component, whether it's in the Central Valley or the North Coast, in the restoration of this species, taking it literally from endangered to you can have a conservation harvest with a good conscience. The wrinkle, and I appreciate what Brad brought in terms of the experience there, it's a very different paradigm for us to close a state wildlife area during a hunting opportunity and rely on private lands. But the purpose of this is to provide relief to landowners that have been feeding these geese and made it possible, you know, for their recovery. That is going to require a lot of education on our part, but please understand, it's not about reducing opportunity on public lands. It's having a sanctuary for the birds and hazing them off, whether through, you know, off the private land, so there gets to be some balance there. With that, I need to be quiet, I think.
Thank you. We have two public speakers on this. Art Spalding, followed by Virginia Handley. 3 minutes each, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Art Spalding. I live in Ojai at 2046 Los Encinos Road. I've appeared several times before your honorable body, and what I have to say may sound like a broken record. And I should pause and let you know that the last time I used that simile was on my grandchildren, and their reply is, "Granddad, what is a broken record? What is a record?" Well, anyway, may it please the Commission, I'd like to address you further on the same topic that I have been here before, and that is that I represent the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association, and to tell you about some of our problems, which have been historic. The first of those has to do with water. The cost of water has always been a continuing problem for us, and to a great extent, we've made inroads in providing our member clubs with enough water at lower cost. And so that ceases to be the pressing problem that it used to be. But on the other hand, a companion problem has to do with ducks. And if you don't have ducks and water, you don't have clubs. And the member clubs that we have, there are 40 of them, are in danger of perishing for the lack of either or both of those commodities. Our 40 member clubs represent about 5,000 acres of marshlands, which we flood annually. They represent a significant amount of flooded properties for the migration of waterfowl. Our TBWA, which is the abbreviation I should use, was formed in 1992 expressly to address the cost of water and to talk about the duck season when the occasion presented itself. We have told you, I think, many times before that we have an early migration even before the outset of the hunting season, which in the past several years has been in the northern part of California early on October, and in the, for last year, by way of example, on the, I think it was the 22nd of October. Now, that early migration literally deluges our ponds toward the end of September. But early in October, that migration disappears, and they head for Mexico like so many others. The consequence is that our duck season really doesn't begin until the first part of December with any promise of success. And so we are here once again to urge you to consider an earlier opening of the waterfowl season, earlier than, say, the 21st of October, as would be likely under last year's conditions. And if we could open it, for example, on the 7th of October this year, that would be ideal for our member clubs. There would be a closure of perhaps 10 days in order to comply with the limitations of the federal framework, but reopening again toward the first part or middle of November would be quite agreeable with us. So my recommendation to you at this point would be that you seriously consider that the season for the Southern San Joaquin Valley zone, which provides an ideal opportunity for us to enjoy better hunting early in the season, you consider that and give us the benefit of your action in that connection. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, very much.
Thank you, Art. Virginia Handley.
Hello, Virginia Handley, Animal Switchboard. I can't believe there's only two people that want to get up on a subject as broad, as important as this, particularly when the issue of the moto ducks, the robo ducks, I don't know how many names one device can have. And that is covered in your environmental document, and it seems to be plain to everybody that the mortality that's raised, and even just common sense will say, well, you know, with the amount of time and money that's invested by a hunter to go out hunting, if he meets his bag limit in the first half hour or hour, how do we know that he's just going to stop and go home? And for him, his hunting day is over. They go over the bag limits. Who's going to know? We have no wardens. And we also have an existing law about the issue of these unretrieved ducks, which is a tremendous number of animals that are not retrieved, that are either go off crippled, die later. Hopefully some might recover, but most likely they're going to die in some other way or by a predator. And the environmental document shows the amount of chances of crippling loss and particularly of the non-retrieval. Well, we have a law in Fish and Game that you are not supposed to just go out and shoot animals, kill animals, and leave them out there in the wild unretrieved, that is a waste of the resource. And I'd like to see that applied to a lot of these unretrieved ducks. But I think the department should be recommending and the commission voting to get rid of the moto ducks. We ban live ducks How many years ago did we do that? In the 1930s or something, where you can't just tie a duck up and put them out in the water because of this very reason that they were too effective in attracting other ducks there. Another issue that is very much of a concern to me personally is with the environmental document. Now, under existing law, and I wish I could quote the exact, whether it's Fish and Game Code 202.1, 203.1, but anyways, those things which the commission must consider when they set their regulations. One of those things that they must consider under law, the welfare of individual animals. In the past, in the environmental documents, there is always a chapter on this. I'm very concerned that this environmental document does not have any reference to that law. It doesn't have any reference that the material in here, it says impacts on individual animals and covers the various shotguns, falconry, archery dogs. But it is not meeting the requirement of the law that you are to consider the welfare of individual animals, and this material in the document does not do that. And when you cover the use of archery, it's covered in there too, of the issue of the increased suffering and pain that the animal goes through. If one would really consider that as you're supposed to be doing, and the fact that there is not so much archery, it doesn't have a big impact one way or another on the populations. One should consider to ban the use of archery on the use of birds because the amount of suffering to the individual animal. I really think you need to look at this document and see that you are making a reference to the existing law of which you must consider and reflect it in your document. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments from the department? We need a motion to authorize staff to publish notice of commission intent to amend the migratory game bird waterfowl regulations for 06-07.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And we still could do some fine-tuning on the 25th in August, right?
Adoption hearing is scheduled for August 25th in Santa Barbara.
Cool. Thank you.
But as far as fine-tuning, yes, there will be some opportunity then, yep.
Thank you.
Moving on to item 16, request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to amend sections 163 and 164, Title 14, regarding commercial herring fishery and harvesting of herring eggs on kelp. The commission will receive public testimony at its August 4th, 06 meeting in Sacramento, and the adoption hearing is scheduled for August 25th, 06 in Santa Barbara. Sankey?
Good morning, commissioners. As you have in your package, this is a notice, request to go to notice. The summary of the current status is the herring fishery is doing much better. There's a bunch of changes to Mollis Bay. We want to set a quota at 350 tons and take away in-season adjustments. San Francisco Bay, you have three options. There are a lot of herring, and the 10% quota we typically use would produce a quota of 14,505 tons. Interestingly, when the Director's Herring Advisory Committee looked at this, because of market situation, number of fishermen, they actually prefer the option three, which is a status quo on quota of only 4,502 tons. They don't want to catch that many herring. That's good news. The herring population seems to be doing very good. And there is numerous other miscellaneous changes being proposed, which you'll take testimony at the next meeting. If you have any specific questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Yeah, I just want to say that thank you, Sankey, for sharing that with us. That the word I got was that there's more herring than there's ever been before out there.
Apparently, and you can walk across the bay on them.
And so that just confirms that we did make a correct decision a couple of years ago when we didn't shut that fishery down, and I just like hearing those positive things, kind of like that goose.
No, yeah, this is a good news. As you remember, we were concerned We couldn't, or data wasn't really sure where it was going to go. The good news is we have a very robust population based on our surveys. And as a note, also on the Tomales Bay, we have been doing a study on mesh size in Tomales, and based on the results, we are recommending the same 2-inch mesh in Tomales as we have in San Francisco, so we now have a standard mesh size.
So, and the fact that the fishermen are saying, let's stay with the status quo, proves what I always said, that they're really interested and concerned about that fishery being viable and surviving. So.
This is good news. I mean, we have a fishery that's coming together and things are looking up. All they need now is a market for their fish.
I'd like to have those good news reports.
Well, commissioners, we have no public speaker cards on this issue, this item, so I need a motion.
I move that we proceed to authorize the department to proceed to notice.
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Moving on to item 17, consideration and possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 679, Title 14, regarding wildlife rehabilitation. Doug Updike looks like he might have left the room.
He was here.
He was.
Essentially, as you know, we've heard discussions over several commission meetings. We've incorporated the recommendations we thought appropriate. We've submitted our final proposal, and now it's a matter of whether you are happy enough to adopt it as proposed or not. If you have specific questions, I'll try and answer them.
The only question I had, we did receive correspondence this morning when we sat down regarding the fencing issue. There had been some testimony at Lake Tahoe regarding the fencing issue as it relates to local city codes, that sometimes what we were requiring would put people in opposition to that. And when Doug gets back, maybe he could speak to why that was, or maybe you know why it wasn't included, those changes.
Yeah, our fencing requirements are designed from advice we've gotten on humane standards. We realize in some places that may be a conflict with the county or city codes. That's something that the proponent will have to work out. It's just we don't feel comfortable in a place to compromise our humane fencing standards for the animals. I mean, that's an unfortunate situation, but we're not sure a reasonable alternative.
Okay.
It looks like Doug is back.
Doug is back.
Yeah, Doug, did you hear the question on the fencing?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't.
It was the issue of they received comment on the fact that we have a fencing standard which may be in conflict with some county and city, and I explained that our standards are based on humane standards, and we feel uncomfortable compromising that because of some ordinance in the county that may have a maximum height of so many feet. I'm not sure what the specific comments are. I haven't seen the letter that you got.
I don't recall seeing that item either. I know that in many cases where we have an issue covered by multiple jurisdictions, that we end up needing to comply with all, usually in order to proceed. I apologize. You're much quicker than I had expected on the agenda item.
No problem. Well, I'm comfortable with the response. I just wanted to make sure I asked the question again because we had asked about this at the Lake Tahoe meeting, and I think in those situations people probably have to move their facilities or not deal with those same animals in backyards, and they may have to move out of those urbanized areas to do that so that they don't have those requirements. And I think that's unfortunate, but we have to take care of those animals in a humane manner. So,
I just have one. One quick comment. Thank you. I mean, I think you. I just want to compliment you and the Wildlife Rehabilitation Community. I remember when this first came up, there was 20 or 30 people with concerns. Mm-hmm. Then the meeting after that, there was 10. Then there was 4, and today in the adoption proposal, there are none. So I'm guessing everything has been worked out. I just think that's a good cooperative effort. Mm-hmm. I think you did a good job. Unless I'm wrong.
No, there are 3 comment letters we received, still concerned with the issues on the fees. I don't see a way around that. We need the revenue for the department. So you know, with that, I'll move approval.
I think we have public testimony.
We have one public speaker.
Yeah. Okay,
and
Virginia.
If we're done with questions to the department, Virginia Handley.
I didn't know Virginia was speaking, and here I said everybody was happy. Yeah. Oops.
It's hard to be happy.
It feels so much better.
We can pretend to be happy. Virginia Handley, Animal Switchboard. There is, I know of at least one big issue left, two actually. Under the what is being asked now, still it only allows for when someone wants to start a new wildlife rehab center, that they have to depend on letters from the nearest wildlife rehabilitation facilities to say that a new facility is needed. That's like asking McDonald's if they need a Burger King down the street. It's not always the most reliable source of information, although it certainly should be included. But it should be expanded that you can also receive input from other organizations and agencies, such as the local animal control department. They're the ones who get the calls. I'm Animal Switchboard. I get the calls from the public when they have an injured wild animal, and we do have them in San Francisco. What are they supposed to do? And then I can refer them to the, many times I have to refer them all the way over to Marin, which they're not going to go that far. Cost you $5 to get back into the city, for one thing. I found the more the better, in my opinion. But to allow an expansion of not just letters from the local wildlife rehab centers, because we have found that there are even some that they'll say, oh, no, we don't need any, but yet they're overcrowded with animals, or they may be even turning animals away because they can't take them. But are they going to sign a letter? Yes, we want somebody moving in the same county. They may not. So please to, and I would consider this just a technical amendment of just expanding what input you can get from other agencies and organizations as to whether a need is there. And then the another one is very important legally, too, in that you are adopting the minimum standards in toto of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Council, I believe. But anyway, in there it says, if a veterinarian intends to keep or treat any animal for more than 24 hours, the vet must have the appropriate wildlife permit or be listed as a submerged permittee to the wildlife rehabber. Well, this is in direct conflict to existing law about veterinarians being able to care for restricted species, and it does allow them to take in injured wildlife or an animal under the restricted species. It does not limit the amount of time that he can hold the animal, and he certainly does not have to get a permit from Fish and Game to have that animal. So we're putting into a regulation something that is in direct conflict to a current Fish and Game law. So I think those are two things that really need to be tweaked here. And you have the veterinarian must be available for follow-up. You know, many of these places, they use a number of veterinarians. For these veterinarians, they're dedicating their time most often. So an animal may get some treatment, get some stitches for some injury, go back to the wildlife rehab. Something happens. Well, they may not be able to get right back to that same vet. Maybe they'll go to another veterinarian who also works with them. And so to restrict that any follow-up care must be done exactly with the same veterinarian, I think, is too restrictive, too. So if there's any way to make some of these modifications, I don't think they're serious enough to have to go back out to notice. Personally, I don't think so. But if you consider that, please.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Updike.
I appreciate Virginia's comments. The issue here, though, is they're mixed situations. There's a definition here in 679 as far as following those guidelines that would let the veterinarian work with the rehabber. The intention is that the rehab facility is a place where the animal will spend time. So it's not an intention here to mix up any kind of aspect with the veterinarian. So quite frankly, the two don't conflict. They're in different circumstances.
Quick question on the first point that Virginia made, because I just have confusion.
Right.
I mean, when we're determining need for wildlife rehabilitation centers, and my guess is we're going to need more with urban sprawl, you know, impacting animal habitat and on and on and on. But I thought what we were doing here, I thought, correct me or explain this to me, in the old way, our regional managers would determine if a new wildlife rehabilitation facility was needed. And I thought what we were doing was we were adding to that other wildlife rehabilitation facilities could determine, and Virginia's point is well taken, why would they want to if they were competitive? But we need some other determinant besides a competitive, already existing wildlife rehab. You know what I'm trying to say? So I'm wondering how we could be more inclusive to create an opportunity if it's there in the real world.
I think many of the wildlife rehabilitators prefer to have it set up so that it's neighboring ones that help make the decision. Quite frankly, it's a small community, and they oftentimes will agree among themselves, we're swamped here. There's so much stuff going on. We need somebody else to help. That was the intent, to get a fair way to gauge a need in an area locally. There's already a great deal of cooperative nature. I don't think it's as much competitive as it may have been described as. While I'm sure there's some competition, when there's truly a need, the best ones to identify that usually are a couple of other rehab facilities locally.
Okay, and all I want to say is that I understand they're all working together now, good faith effort. And you said to help make. Who has final authority though? The neighboring wildlife rehabilitator, our regional manager, a combination of both. I mean, I'm just wondering. What if some activists out there said we need one, and the other wildlife rehabber said we don't? How would we solve that problem? And I'm not saying that exists. Yeah, but
I think it's clear to understand the thing we're referring to here is the application process. The department still maintains final control. Okay. We weigh a lot of information. Okay. This is just part of the application procedures. We're looking for input from neighboring rehabbers. It is not the only information we use.
So they won't be rejected if there's, in Bob's scenario, one that says, yes, we need one, and the other says, no, we don't. They can't get a second letter.
That would probably just stimulate more questions.
Yes.
More questioning. So it would still be up to the regional manager.
So we still have some. Okay, thank you.
The department always maintains independent judgment and final call.
I just
want
to make sure we weren't taking ourselves out of the equation.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Thank you. That is all the public testimony we have. excuse me, I need a motion. To amend Section 679.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
No, really, and thanks to all the people that worked on this.
Next item?
Yes, thank you. Item 18, consideration and possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 7.50, Subsection B, Subsection 178, Title 14, regarding Silver King Creek. Neil Manji.
Good morning, Commissioners, Commission staff. Neil Manji, Fisheries Branch. At your May meeting, if you remember, there was quite a bit of testimony regarding the department's proposed regulation to close a section of Silver King Creek from Snodgrass Creek to Llewellyn Falls for the protection of Paiute cutthroat trout above the falls, at which time there is several members from Alpine County and the Packers Association, which was trying to find a compromise to that closure, which was approximately 6 miles at which time you asked the department to go back and review and try to come to an agreement with the Packers and Alpine County's proposal to limit that from Tamarack Lake Creek upstream to Llewellyn Falls, which was approximately 3,800 feet, a little over half a mile. In doing so, the department agreed and have prepared an amended pre-adopt statement and is in support of that right now and willing to go forward for the adoption.
Yeah, I have one public testimony if there's no questions. Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. It's not nice to fool with Mother Nature. And what we have done here now, I think you need to go back and check above Llewellyn Falls, because the operator of this concession knows and realizes that the only way to keep these creeks open and his business survivable is to contaminate the genetic reservoir and gene pool of the fish above the falls. This would be considered environmental terrorism, ecological sabotage, and crimes against nature. And he realizes that that's the only way to keep this lake, this river open. And I believe that this has already been done since the last meeting. So unless you get out there and check again and have a constant patrol, there is no chance for this species to stay pure. This is a problem that aquaculture has given us. You have fouled the genetic reservoir of our golden trout, the state fish. You're allowing releasing of genetically altered and artificially propagated hybrids into the waters of California, and it continues. And why is it? Because of the grant money, because you're able to access tax dollars for these hatcheries. And it is it's a crime against nature, and it's despicable what you have allowed to happen. And we are losing our natural species because of the introduction from aquaculture, which you people have allowed to continue with no accountability on the crimes that they have committed. And now the legislature, too little, too late, are going to enact laws to try and keep this from happening. It's a shame. Any questions?
Thank you. If there's no questions, commissioners, I need a motion to amend Section 7.50.
Chair moves.
Okay, I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Moving on to number 19, consideration and adoption, possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 27.80, Title 14, Ocean Salmon Fishing Regulations. Neil Manji?
Sankey.
Well, Sankey said that you... Well,
yeah.
He deferred upwards. Okay.
The department's proposal can be summarized as you see in your packets, where we set minimum size for salmon that may be retained, number of rods, bait, number of salmon that may be retained. This is to put in place regulations that have already started and just to conform them state waters.
Okay.
We have one public speaker on this item, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. We're not able to get the true perspective of what's going on in the salmon fishing. First of all, we have 1.5 million sport fishermen. On one day, they take over 1.5 million fish out of the ocean. One day of fishing. That's a conservative estimate. You have 1,500 commercial fishermen. A total year's catch is less than 250,000 fish. So a year of the commercial fishery is five times less than one day of the sport fishing take. You're not being amiable or honest about the true reasonings for this push on the changes of ocean fishing regulations. And all you are doing are attacking people because you are not saving the resource, allowing the sport fishermen no constrictions. This is not amiable, it is not equitable, and it's not truly showing the true perspective of what's going on. Any questions?
If there are no questions, we need a motion to amend Section 27.80, Title
Moved.
14.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Next item is item 20, request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to amend section 632 sub B 72 title 14 regarding commercial lobster fishing in Dana Point State Marine Park. And that'll be Sankey.
Yes. Good morning, commissioners. This is the notice to deal with a request by the Lobster and Trap Fishery Association to allow for the commercial take of lobster in Dana Point State Marine Park. The commission, if it would like to do that in time for the opening of the lobster season, the commission would need to make a motion today to publish notice in order to consider the changes in regulations. There would be a single discussion and adoption hearing in late August in order to change for the change to be effective beginning, as I said, lobster season. However, on our review, which was quite extensive, we gave you a full history because of the unique nature of this in legislation. The department has expressed in our transmittal memo that we recommend that before the commission actually adopts the change, that you provide a copy of the proposal to the legislature for review or some form of notification as was required by law. And basically what the provision is to allow commercial lobster fishing in Dana Point. And the ISOR has provided a very thorough background and justification and rationale if you have any questions.
None at this point. We have public testimony.
Yeah, we have four public speaker cards if there's no questions at this point of the department. John Guth, followed by Roger Healy, followed by John Duffy, followed by Paul Weakland. 3 minutes each, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I'm the president of the California Lobster and Trap Fishermen's Association. My name is John Guth. And we brought this issue in front of the subcommittee, which is now the resource committee. And I think Commissioner Gustafson was there, and Commissioner Rogers. And historically, I think you have the history in front of you if you've read the review and the initial statements. So we're requesting that that the commission take action, and we don't know exactly what that is. If you can do it under Title 14, and we hope that you can, to let us resume fishing in an area that we have fished historically. And basically, in the interest of time, that's our request in a nutshell. We also, in your document, and I'd like to thank the department for fast-tracking this and Sankey for getting on this and trying to get it done for us before next season. There's a little information that I think would have been valuable, that would have been from our log book entries that shows a little better picture of what the exact take and what we really are missing by not fishing in the area that's represented. And John Ugritz presented it fairly well, I believe, and I think he did use, I'm not positive of this, but as we sat at the dock and used our own log books, which are more than just the generic fish ticket that shows a block number that we fish in, and the catch in that block number, the logbooks actually show the depth that we work in and an area within the block number, so they're a little more specific. And as we compare them amongst ourselves, because we don't have access to the entire logbook information, the department has that, it's private, but we as fishermen that fish in that area compared our logbooks, and we showed at least the five or six of us that did that, we showed at least 50% of the catch that we have in the 757 block number in front of Dana Point came out of the new proposed closure that was supposedly an old closure that we had been fishing in historically since the history of the fishery. So it would be good if that was reflected. It would show that it's not an insignificant area of 10% of the catch. We show in our records, as best we can show amongst ourselves, a few of us that gathered together, we showed at least 50 to 60% catch in that closed area, because there are other concerns there. There's a jetty closure, there's a channel closure in that block number that comes out of Dana Point that we're not allowed to fish in, and there's also a boat traffic problem that we have if we fish outside of that closure. So it's a very important area for the guys. There's 28 boats there that are 28 to 27, 26 that fish in there every year. And so that's our concern, and I thank you for considering it and trying to fast track it here. Thank you.
Thank you. Roger Healy, followed by John Duffy.
Good morning, Executive Director and Commission members. I'm Roger Healy. I'm president of the Dana Cove Commercial Fishermen's Association. I represent 25 of the 28 boats that to fish out of Dana Point Harbor. I was just going to reiterate, John covered basically everything that needs to be said, and we also like to thank the department and his fast action and expediting this before the commercial lobster season begins. There is a little bit of, it's tough to read the pack that was given out because it is a little miscued as far as there's a 4.4 nautical mile area, the 757 block area that we utilize. And like John said, there is a large part of it that's covered by the harbor, as well as a channel which you aren't allowed to fish in, as well as south of the harbor there's a no boat area that goes out 1200 feet, which is also not utilized commercially. So of that 4.4 considered fishable area in the less than 60 foot depth area, it might actually be about half that area. And myself personally, as well as is a not even a good percentage, but as the numbers show, is almost the whole entire fleet fishes that area and has fished it since the inception of our fishery at off Dana Point, which is about 1908 to 1910 or something. So we just would appreciate the commission's action and try to expedite this and try to obtain our fishery and have it back the way it was by lobster season if we could, and appreciate your time. If you have any questions, I can answer them too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. John Duffy, followed.
My comments have been covered. I won't take your time.
Thank you, John. Then our last public speaker on this issue is Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Now, in the past meetings, we have heard the Department of Fish and Game saying, we don't know why the regulations were made like this, because you have not done good homework. Dana Point is a very unusual area because of the topography and the habitat on the bottom there. In a close confines and in a small area, you have all the descriptive habitat types. This was noticed and recognized early on, and that's why these regulations were put in place, so that we could judge, gauge, and evaluate the different types of harvesting. Unfortunately, our biologists have failed us, and that all of these follow-up studies, because they are so biased in their opinions, and this does not conform with their views, so they throw their hands up and don't know why it's like this. We do not believe that any area in California should be closed to lobster fishing, except perhaps the entrances of the harbors and any large boating areas, such as this channel that they are talking about. Because the science purports that lobster fishing in the manner that is being done now, prescribed by the Fish and Game Commission, is not detrimental to the resource. And so having closed areas for this fishery makes no sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That concludes public speaking on this issue.
And one quick question. I'm sorry, when it's to Sankey. I'm wanting to support this proposal, and I think the Dana Point fishermen, lobster guys, have been really responsible. I like them. I like lobster. Want to give them more opportunity. Actually, I love Dana Point. When I was a surfer kid, we used to go to places that don't exist. Salt Creek and Swamis and all those places that don't exist anymore. Anyway, but do we get in conflict with state law? As I understand it, and you mentioning us notifying the legislature, when the state park was created, they said certain types of activities were allowed. And as I understand it, if we want to allow anything else, we have to change the reg and give the permit and let the legislature know. Is that it? Or they don't have to they don't have to approve what we do they? Or do they?
This turns out the reason the eyesore is as extensive as it is, this is an interesting situation because of the legislative history of this particular refuge. And there is some disagreement among some legal interpretations of how it proceeds. The department believes, though, that you must notify the legislature. Okay. It is not a permission. They have 60 days to respond, and then it automatically defaults if they don't comment.
Okay.
And that's why we recommend that, because there is another statute, as the ISOR describes, that requires it. Speaking to the economics, we clearly state in the document, there's a wide range of, we just did another analysis. We're not disagreeing. It's economically important, and we support the change. The issue really is the process and the nature of this reserve, and right. We just made you make you aware, and I understand your legal counsel has some concerns that I'll let him talk to.
You do?
With that, Mr. President, members of the commission, Bill Cunningham, and thank you, Mr. Mastrop. I do have some concerns as well. As you may have also read through the detailed ISOR that the department put together, they come to two different areas of concern. Zonke mentioned one of them. This is a requirement under Section 2861 of the Fish and Game Code, which talks about modifications of MLPAs and MPAs, and it specifically talks about the modification of an existing MPA, especially one that would make inoperative a statutory MPA, and that's what we're talking about here. It suggests that the Commission shall provide a copy to the legislature for review by the Joint Committee on Fisheries and Aquaculture in the legislature, or if there is no such a committee, to the appropriate policy committees in each house of the legislature. And that does appear to be what we are doing. It would be also apparent that we must make such a referral to the legislature for their review, and it's not just a transmittal. The statutory language says review by that committee, and that we may need to do that before we can make a change as we propose here. It's probably even more important that we do such a review request, because if you look at the proposed language drafted up as it currently sits, this isn't just a regulatory change that says we're changing Dana Point Reserve from a park to a management area. The language we've actually put in to the regulation is going to make ineffective more than a dozen statutory references. And I would suggest that in an excess of caution, it would behoove us to make this referral to the legislature for their review. Because we are talking about now taking statutory refuges and redefining their uses, specifically by allowing commercial use in a refuge that apparently at no time ever contemplated the use of commercial fishing operations. So I think we have to be very careful in what we're going to do, and I would suggest that this legislative review and referral is going to be a critical element. I'd like to ask the department, though, to also talk with us a little about a second issue that's been raised. When the marine protected areas were all redefined some time ago, back in, I think, 2004, the department, the commission, and others worked through an entity called the State Interagency Coordination Committee, which was created through the Public Resources Code. And this was a multi-agency committee that was trying to make sense of all kinds of refuges, reserves, and management areas and create some kind of consistency. And when we went through them, we originally then adopted our Section 632, which now uses the more standardized phrases of reserves, conservation areas, and so forth, parks. And this committee worked with us and agreed with our regulatory changes, in which we took a whole range of reserves and we put them into now very specific regulatory criteria and categories. My question is are we going to have to think about going back to this interagency group as well, because we are talking about taking something out of a park and putting it in a conservation area. We are now going to redefine how it's going to be used within that category. Now, I'm not sure whether that was a one-time classification criteria or not, but that also is a second sub-issue to look at. And Zonke's, I think, got an answer.
Yeah, that was a one-time effort, and with the new MLPA and MLMA Improvement Act, or the MLPA Improvement Act, that we feel that kind of superseded that pre-existing committee, and so that under the commission's current authority, we would use that instead, and we would not need to go back to a committee. There is no committee.
Okay. Because I was concerned about that. I also had a question for the department in that in the ISOR itself, it suggests that when the other six Orange County refuges were recategorized from parks to conservation areas in 2005, there was an understanding that the Dana Point would remain unique and remain a park rather than a conservation area. Is there some reason that we're now changing or willing to accept the change? I was under the impression when we did this in 2005 that everybody was happy with what happened and that there was a reason why we took the six, but we did not take the seven, and I can see that. The Dana Point Refuge in discussion in statute is very different than the other six Orange County refuges. But it was also my understanding that at that time, even the commercial fishermen were willing to accept the distinction between the other six Orange County refuges and this one, but now apparently have abandoned such a distinction.
That's not quite accurate. When the Lobster Association requested that we fix the designations to allow a longstanding practice, I met with staff when we reviewed the proposals. During that review process, we ran into the unique legislative identity in the code, Dana Point, that's different than the other six that we changed. And at the time, we concluded that we really did not have the authority or it was appropriate to change it under the process we used for the other six because of the unique designation. So we pulled it off. The lobster fishermen, and they'll correct me if I'm wrong, always assumed we included Dana Point and were a little surprised when they discovered we hadn't included it. And then upon their bringing this to your attention, you requested that we change Dana Point to allow this practice. So you directed us to do this.
Okay, I wasn't unclear about the rest of it.
Yeah.
But I would still, again, my critical issue that I wanted to bring to the commission is the same one the department has raised, and that's this requirement, apparently rather clearly stated in statute, that we must make a review and referral to the legislature when we propose this kind of modification of our reserves and our refuges. So it does put a bit of a clinker in here because that's going to impact the time schedule that is currently being discussed, I think.
Great. All I wanted to say is I've looked into this because people have asked me to, and I'm not an attorney, and of course that's why we have people like Mr. Cunningham. I thought we were authorized to make a change, but then, of course, we had to make the recommendation to the legislature. We can't control what they do. It'll be up to these folks and others to lobby them. And if they don't change what we do within 60 days, it becomes the law. But my only other question in this was when I was checking with people, because, you know, these things have importance and historical significance to all kind of folks. I wasn't aware, and maybe I haven't done my homework, that we were actually changing the name of Dana Point State Marine Park. Do we have to change? See, people are going to not want us to downgrade a park, but I don't think they're going to mind this use in a park. And all I'm trying to say is I would like to allow this use without changing the name of the park, because I think when it does go to the Joint Committee on Fisheries and Aquaculture, Assemblywoman Patty Berg and Senator West Chesboro may be uncomfortable with the downgrading of an area that was designated as a park to something else. So all I'm trying to say is I'm asking the question of how can we let these guys, you know, trap lobster and still have it done in Dana Point State Park. Is that possible?
The Marine Life Management, or the Marine Life Protection Act, excuse me, clearly states that we have they define the designations and what's permitted. It's an attempt to standardize. One of the intents was to standardize this bizarre variation in designations. Yep. You cannot have it be a park under the MLPA and allow commercial take. That's prohibited under the name. So one is, I think it may be a matter of education. I don't believe a conservation area is any worse or not as good as a park. It's just a different.
Others would argue.
Right.
Okay.
and we could maybe help with some of that education and outreach. That's part of the MLPA process, is to educate the public what these things are. But you cannot designate it as a park and allow commercial take.
I'm still okay with that, but that's where we may run into problems with the legislature. Just so join the menu. Okay, keep. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to monopolize this conversation.
You haven't.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, I had that question. Do you want staff to work with landing, getting this to the joint committee? How do we get this to the joint committee? That's the question.
Okay. Chair's going to move this motion.
So we're going to notice, right?
We'll go to notice.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. You'll work with yes,
Mr. President, just very briefly, I'd like to recognize John Ugritz and Sankey and Marcy, who's here. This is a case study in kind of the tangled web of accumulated statutes. And if I can read it and it makes sense to me, they did a wonderful job. So it was a great staff effort.
Thanks, guys.
Mr. President, if I might ask for a clarification, are you, as I understand, we're going to notice, are we also going to be asking staff and the department to help go ahead and prepare
Yes, I've
this
already
proposal?
Instructed the executive director to do so.
Okay, because we're going to need apparently that review and approval before, as the statute says, prior to adoption. So we're going to need that kind of review before we have the adoption decision here in the cycle. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead, next item.
Item 21, discussion and receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to sections 5.3.03, 149, and 149.1, Title 14, regarding non-transferable squid light boat permits, squid permit fees, and revision of light boat logbook form. Please note that the proposal on public testimony is limited to establishment of a non-transferable market squid light boat permit category, adjustment of permit fees for all squid permit classes, and revision of light boat logbook form. Additional public discussion is scheduled for August 25th, 06 in Santa Barbara. An adoption hearing is scheduled for October 6th, 06 in San Diego. There was an issue with this. There were some last-minute technical details, and this has not actually been noticed yet, is my understanding, but we can take public testimony today and discussion, still hold public testimony and discussion on the 25th, and then still adopt on October 6th, and I believe that's fine with everybody. Mr. Cunningham, do you have any issues with that? You're busted.
Busted, I'm sorry. I was speaking with our staff analyst here. Would you please rephrase that for me?
Well, I just wanted to make it clear that this actually, because of some last-minute technical issues on the eyesore, has not been noticed yet. And but so we should be any day now. We can still take public testimony today. We still have public testimony lined up for August 25th in Santa Barbara, and then adoption in October 6th in San Diego. So I believe we'll still meet all of the
That's
requirements.
Fine. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Sankey has the department's story on this.
Yes, as the commissioners know, at its May meeting, the commission decided to go to notice to change the regulations for commercial squid restricted access program by allowing a seventh class of squid permits. What you have before you is based on the recent public testimony, and the commission has agreed to create a class of non-transferable light boat permits to accommodate 20-year commercial fishermen who did not qualify under the criteria the commission established for other squid permit classes in 2005. The department expects that there may be two qualifiers for this permit, but we think no more than six on the outside. Also at the May meeting, based on a request by the department, the commission agreed to consider increasing all squid permit fees to more adequately cover the department costs associated with the fishery management plan the commission adopted, and particularly the restricted access program. The the eyesore has a very lengthy attempt to estimate our costs and give you a perspective on that. And once you read that and have questions, we'll be certainly happy to answer any questions. What we specifically would like to get some direction is you will see that we're proposing a across-the-board fee increase in a range of fees from $5,000 to $8,000 per permit as a range. The current permit fees range from about $650 to $2,200. A fee of $6,500 would basically cover the costs estimated by the department if you charge them all the same fee. One of the questions the department would like some guidance from the commission is, are you comfortable at least with the fee range of $5,000 to $8,000, or do you want to consider a different range? Because we could make those adjustments before we file the notice formally.
For me, I'm comfortable with it. I remember Marcy, I think, originally, when we were talking all about this, mentioned the range. The nature of this fishery has become very lucrative. It doesn't mean anybody should be penalized, but to have a fee covering the cost, especially for any, you know, new activities, makes sense to me. We haven't heard any big organized hue and cry against this, and maybe we will in the next two hearings, but I'm comfortable with it. I think it was looked at and analyzed, and this was a recommendation. It wasn't just something that was put out there to penalize anybody, so I think let's go with it, unless we hear differently.
And just to tie it into, on the back wall, the chart I showed you, the marine region yesterday, we pinned it up in case you are interested in looking at it more. We can describe, there is a whole section unit that works largely on squid. It's a substantial fishery. Yeah. It's a very lucrative. It's an important fishery. We need to be doing more work to maintain it and run it properly. The good news is the fishery is helping cooperatively to doing some research. That's fantastic. We appreciate that. But our costs, we are spending more on this fishery than we're getting in on fees, and we'd like to remedy that. As the commissioners who are on at the August meeting when you adopted the squid FMP and the original fees, you'll remember we had actually asked for a higher fee to cover our costs. We weren't fortunate enough to get that from the commission. And since then, we've had some ability to refine what it's going to take to really implement the fishery management plan and to manage this restricted fishery. And these fee recommendations reflect that.
And these were already the compromise, the ones that you recommended.
Yeah. So, and again, we're certainly willing to discuss what we can provide for it and any potential compromises. Just you gave us permission to put before you what we think we need to run the fishery, and we've provided that.
We have two public comment speakers on this issue. John Duffy, followed by Paul Weakland. 3 minutes each, please.
Good morning, President Flores and members of the commission. I'm John Duffy, and I would like to thank the commission and the department for moving forward to address this matter. I believe you have before you a letter from Mr. Dan Williams, one of those fishermen who will be impacted by your actions on the light boat question. In addition, I would like to ask you to direct the department to broaden the range of options for you to consider during the rulemaking process, specifically by including an option for those permits to be fully transferable. In the draft eyesore that I saw, and because it is a draft and hasn't been published, Section 8101 is cited as the authority section for the light boat permit action. But 8101 does not include the word non-transferable in its language. Instead, it authorizes the commission to define the qualifying criteria for 20-year fishermen to be included in the initial year of a limited entry fishery. The department does go to considerable length to justify why they believe these permits should be non-transferable. There are many who disagree with their logic and who believe that Section 8101 of the code is intended to provide for full and equal participation in the initial year of the limited entry fishery. Regardless of which view you might choose to accept, it's simply not possible to consider if that option is not included in the notice that you publish. In fact, that's exactly why you're going through this part of that rulemaking now, because the option for an 8101 light boat permit in any form was not included in the regulations you adopted in August of 04. So in the sense of due process, I respectfully request that you do direct the department to provide for an option for you to consider for those permits to be fully transferable. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, John. Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. We need some clarification on this exorbitant and hiked up fee requirement. With these fees, Zonkey Mastriff says that you can cover all the maintenance of the fishery. So this will eliminate all the landing tax. So no landing tax will be associated with this fishery because the fees will cover the cost. The other thing is I'd like to talk about the different types of permits. They say there's seven different types of permits now in the squid fishery. I have an analogy. A transferable permit in a fishery gives you a vested interest in your livelihood. A non-transferable permit doesn't allow this. The analogy I'd like to say is it's like on land. If you own the land, you have a vested interest in keeping the maintenance up and a good appearance because of the value of your permit or of your land. Now, a renter, a non-transferable permit, or a man is renting, he doesn't care about the real appearance of the property or of the fishery because he is not having a vested interest in this fishery. A landowner wants to have a high value and a good appearance of the land, where a renter does not have the same incentives. And that is what's going on here with the transferable and non-transferable permits. I could go into this a lot more, and there's a lot more to say about these tiered permit processes, but that's enough for now.
Thank you, Paul. There is no vote necessary today on this, commissioners, if there's no other questions. Department?
Mr. Carlson, I would like to clarify here that this speaker does not work very well. There is a proposed range by the department, and if the commission elects at a later time to change that range, that will require a continuation notice with the Office of Administrative Law. So I just wanted to make that point and make sure that you're all aware of that. That will continue, that will lengthen the process for this.
Thank you, John. Moving on to item 22, verification of adoption of proposed changes to section 7.50, subsection B 91.1, title 14, regarding Klamath Trinity River salmon regulations, regarding the bag limit for brown trout and the opening date April 1st for the Trinity River main stem. This is kind of a cleanup from the, shall I say, tumultuous item in Kings Beach. And there were a few things that, when we checked back on the record, that really weren't clear when the commission voted. So that's what this is for. And Neil can give a little more explanation.
Yes. Morning, Commission. Commission staff, Neil Mangi, Fisheries Branch. As Mr. Carlson stated at your May meeting, you did adopt the angling regulations for 7.50911, the Klamath Trinity regulations, at which time it was unclear whether the Commission had adopted two other components that constituents and stakeholders had asked that we provide in the regulations, which was specifically dealing with the language to allow anglers to keep one brown trout. The other was to deal with the opening of a section of the Trinity River from Old Lewiston Bridge to the Hatchery beginning April 1st rather than the last Saturday in April. I know we had some discussion on that, and it appeared that the commission had adopted those two items, but looking back on it, it was deemed that there wasn't potentially proper notice of those two items. So in doing so, we redid another pre-adopt statement of reasons to include those two, at which time we are in full agreement with those regulations, those changes. Having spoke with NOAA Fisheries, the proponents of the Caltrout, the proponents of the regulations, there is no controversy here, and this is just for clarification. Thank you.
If there are no questions, I could. We need a motion to amend.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Moves us to consent calendar.
Yeah, thank you. On consent calendar, I would like to mention that we have one public speaker card, and then we also have received five letters of opposition to the Spring Valley PLM, which is listed, I believe it's double, it's on the second page, double C, out of Mendocino County. Those letters were responded to by the department, and you have copies of those response letters in your packages also. So unless there's any questions, I'd like to, we'll go with the public speaker card for consent calendar. Paul Weakland, items 23 and 24. And that's the only public speaker card for consent calendar today.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland, we have large anxieties and big problems with these kelp bed leases. We know in the past that the regulations are not enforced on these kelp bed harvesting. They seem to take all they can while they can because it's economically feasible and, you know, quit going out all the time. And there are some violations that have been allowed to exist and to continue. There has been destruction of documents inside these abalone farms showing that the diseases, the antibiotics, the steroids, the growth hormones that are given to these animals have been, what'd you call it, lack of honesty in what is being done inside these abalone farms. And when they try to market these abalones, you know, there aren't many takers when the truth is known. The other thing is, it says here that there's a landing tax of $1.71 per ton for kelp. Well, gee-many, we're going to have a valorem tax on some of these other fisheries. Does $1.71 a ton for this very essential resource item seem to be enough? Well, obviously, since the accountability of aquaculture is deplorable, and you say you don't have enough money to be doing this, I believe that raising this landing tax to at least $50 a ton is appropriate. And it seems that this one here, conservation, the conservancy, they want to duplicate research, they want to be redundant in the research, and they want to continue doing the same as they've been doing, yet this collaboration and the evidence of good work is not there. We don't believe that they're being honest, and the only thing they're after is the grant money that's associated with this conservancy. And these permits are very essential for the grant-sucking proposals that they use to acquire these monies. That is all.
Thank you. Commissioners, any questions? Move consent calendar.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you all. Do you have anything else, Mr. Carlson?
Yeah, one last item before that. I would like to reconfirm with the committee. It's as of yesterday, remember we were talking about setting up a mid-August meeting on MPAs or on the Central Coast, and Mr. Flores is available on August 15th. So I want to confirm with the rest of the commissioners, and if anyone can speak for Mr. Rogers, I believe he is available
that week. He said, yes.
So if August 15th is okay with the rest of the commissioners, we were going to put out a press release today.
That's your better day.
Thank you, Mr. Flores.
You're welcome.
So staff will work with Fish and Game on a press release. August 15th is a good date.
15th.
1-5.
Yep. Thank you, guys.
All day and all night? Just all day.
It'll be a long meeting.
Okay. And that takes us to item number 27, announcement of future meetings.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm sorry,
Adriana, do you need to share that with us?
Well, I'd like to verify that there will be Marine Region staff available on the 15th. I know there's a potential conflicting meeting.
They'll be there.
They're meeting with the Blue Ribbon Task Force, I believe, to do the master plan.
Well, quite honestly, this is more important than the Blue Ribbon Task Force.
Okay,
we'll have to figure out how to deal with it.
Can they change that meeting?
Yeah.
Your meeting in the process is more important to us
okay.
right now.
So
we will make it work.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Announcement of future meetings. Our next meeting is on August 2nd in Sacramento on a special meeting on MPAs. Then August 3rd and 4th, Sacramento, is our regularly scheduled commission meeting.
Okay. Anything else?
We'll be sure.
All right.
Second? Sorry.
All in favor? Have we done that before? We will now. It's unanimous. Thank you all. I hope you all have a good, safe weekend, and we will see you August 2nd. Thank you.